She brought his fingers to her lips and kissed them. And in the morning, it seemed, they still weren't looking for her. Or at least, they hadn't come for her. The only text she had was a brief one from Ani asking if she had heard anything. She texted back that she hadn't, and watched Buckley sleep for another moment more. It crossed her mind that she might never see him again after today. She just didn't know what awaited her in the coming hours, the coming days, the indignities, the accusations, the public and private pain. He was still asleep when she climbed from beneath the sheet and sat for a moment on the side of his bed. The shade was down, but she could tell it was sunny outside. It would be a delightful day at the zoo. She checked the weather on her phone, punching in Charlottesville, Virginia. She saw it was going to be hot and sunny there, too. It was going to be, as these things went, a perfectly lovely day for a funeral. A pair of sea lions popped effortlessly from the water onto the stone platform, spraying the young woman with a bucket of fish as if they were playful black labs that had just come in from the rain. The trainer smiled at them and tossed them each a couple of sardines. Cassie was standing along the rail beside Rosemary. Next to her sister were her two children, Tim and Jessica. Dennis, Rosemary's husband, had moved a few dozen yards away from them, photographing the animals from what he believed was going to be a vantage point that would allow him to capture both the animals and his family. Jessica hadn't yet started third grade, so she was still young enough to laugh and squeal at the sea lion's antics. But Cassie observed that Tim was watching with the feigned disinterest of a rising middle schooler. At least she presumed it was feigned. How could you not enjoy watching sea lions frolic on a Saturday morning in August? Still, he seemed considerably more fascinated by the small drone the zoo had hovering above the sea lions for a video feed inside a nearby gift store. Cassie knew he had one at home that was probably just as sophisticated. Drones were such a guy thing, she thought. It was downright chromosomal. They were both attractive children. Tim was in the midst of a growth spurt, but he was already lanky and slender, his hair the same reddish blonde as hers. His jeans were baggy, and his Royals t-shirt so faded it looked almost like denim. Jessica was overdressed for the zoo, but Rosemary said the child was overdressed for life. Though she was 8, and this was Saturday, and it was the middle of the summer, she was wearing violet wedge heels, a black skirt that had been part of one of her costumes from her June dance recital, and a red velvet blouse with a scoop neck but very long sleeves. Cassie recognized the blouse from the American Girl store. She recognized as well the rhinestone headband Jessica was using to pull her hair back. Cassie had bought her niece the blouse when she had taken her shopping in the spring, and she had bought her the headband at the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul. It had cost maybe a buck. "I want one," Rosemary was saying, smiling at the animals. Her sister had gotten a job a year earlier crunching numbers with a health insurance company in Lexington, and had fallen in love with the gym and the spin classes at the headquarters. Cassie thought she'd never looked healthier. "I think a sea lion would make a great pet."
"You know that's ridiculous,"
Tim chastised his mother, rolling his eyes.
"I do," she said, "but I still want one."
"I kinda do too," Cassie admitted. She looked at her watch. In Virginia, Alex Sokolov's funeral was underway. She conjured in her mind a southern brick church with a clean steeple and a sloping manicured lawn that was a deep green. She thought of his parents and his extended family in the front pew, the wood polished and gleaming in the sun through the stained glass windows. She saw black clothes and white handkerchiefs. She saw the old and the young, and in her head she heard their occasional choked sobs. She heard laughter when someone shared a story about Alex that was charming or funny, or hinted at whatever it was that made him special. Whatever it was. How was it that she knew so little of the man who had died beside her in bed? How was that possible? But she knew the answer. Of course she did. The proof,
as she was wont to joke, was in the proof. All that wine, all that vodka, all that arak. By now, she supposed, the Sokolov family had been informed that the presumed killer, that alleged Black Widow, was not an expat American living in the Emirates, but a flight attendant living in the United States. She imagined the father demanding news and progress from the FBI, and someone from the Bureau reassuring him that the noose was tightening. An arrest was imminent. But was it? The United Emirates couldn't arrest her here. Unless this was deemed a terrorist act, neither could her own country. An extradition could take years. Was it possible that everyone in the world who followed this story would believe she was a killer and there was absolutely nothing they could do? No, not nothing. There was still a civil sword of Damocles dangling by a thin thread above her. And the FBI was interested. That was a fact. That was why Ani was so worried about her. She looked at her phone once again. Still nothing from either Frank Hammond or Ani Maradian. "Who in the world are you expecting to call you?" Rosemary asked. "You're like a teenager, you're checking your phone so much." "The airline," she said. She figured she might as well use the same lie on her family that she had used on Buckley last night. "They might need me on the flight to Rome this evening." "I thought we were all having dinner together." Her sister's lips grew pursed. "We are," said Cassie. "It's a long shot. I'm sure I'll be here with you." But she wasn't sure. Despite the silence from both her lawyer and the FBI, she in fact wondered if she'd get to have dinner with them tonight. She had a canvas bag over her shoulder, and in it was the Romulus and Remus bookend she had stolen from the hotel in Rome, and a pair of her own earrings. They were small gold cats she had bought years ago in an antique store in Frankfurt, but had decided when she was back in America were too precious for a grown woman. This morning, she had repackaged them in a little box from the greeting card store near her apartment and had brought them as a gift for her niece. She decided that she shouldn't wait until Christmas to give her nephew the bookend. Today might be her last, her only chance. And so she wanted to be sure that she had a present for Jessica, too. The word present gave her pause. A memory. Her mother reading aloud to her before bed in Kentucky. Her mother was sitting on the mattress beside her, and Cassie was perhaps 6 years old and curled against her in the narrow twin bed. They were leaning against Cassie's headboard, and Cassie was already in her pajamas. The story tonight was one of Beverly Cleary's books about Beezus and Ramona. "Now, you sit here for the present," her mother read aloud. In the book, it was the first day of school, and a school teacher was telling Ramona to remain in her seat, for the moment. And so Ramona absolutely refused to move because she mistakenly believed there was a gift, a present, waiting for her if she sat perfectly still. Cassie recalled being so happy that evening. She had been roughly Ramona's age. She was enjoying her own first days at school, and her mother was wearing a floral perfume that smothered the coppery scent that usually stuck to her when she came home from the wire factory where she was the receptionist. Cassie heard the crowd around them laughing. One of the sea lions was using its flipper to shake the trainer's paw, and then gently slapped at the woman's open hand as if giving the trainer a high five. "I've got something for you," Cassie said to Jessica. The girl looked up at her. She was beaming. Clearly, her niece loved the animals. Cassie noted that today she was wearing the starfish studs that Rosemary had given her when she had gotten her ears pierced at the start of the summer. "Consider it a back-to-school present," she added, handing the girl the small box. Tim turned toward his sister and smiled.
"Oh, good. More stuff you can lose in that mess you call a bedroom."
Already, the way her niece left her bedroom looking like it had been ransacked by drug addicts was legendary in the family. Apparently, she considered at least 3 or 4 outfits before school every day, leaving the rejects scattered on the rug, or her bed, or the window seat. I have something for you, too, she told the boy, handing him the small wrapped sculpture. Jessica, I got your gift in Frankfurt. Tim, I got yours in Rome.
It's heavier than it looks, he said.
God, your life sounds glamorous. Frankfurt? Rome? If people didn't know better, Rosemary murmured. Over the years, Cassie had shared with her sister dozens of the experiences, some appalling, some merely degrading, that came with the job, so she did know better. It does have its moments, she admitted. Tim waited chivalrously for his younger sister to open the box before pulling apart the red tissue paper that swaddled his gift. The girl cooed when she saw the earrings, and Cassie bent over so her niece could hug her.
I love them, she said.
Then, the words at once strange and precocious coming from a girl so young, she added,
They are perfectly elegant.
Over her shoulder, Tim rolled his eyes. I'm glad you like them, Cassie said. Your turn, she said to her nephew. Tim pulled off the blue ribbon and then tore off the red tissue.
A sculpture, he said simply.
And for a moment, Cassie thought of that old joke. When someone opens a gift and says aloud what it is, a juicer, a Carvac, napkin rings, they hate it. And she felt bad. But the moment lasted only a second because then he went on.
I know this story. It was in a book about the myths that was on my summer reading list. No one connects the twins to werewolves, but I think that's the coolest link.
Is it a paperweight?
Everyone turned at the voice. The children's father had appeared almost out of nowhere and inquired. His camera was around his neck, and he was cleaning his sunglasses with a handkerchief. Dennis McCauley was a big man, not fat and not muscular, but tall and stocky with a stomach that was just starting to grow bulbous. He was handsome, his hair now more white than black, but still lustrous and thick. He parted it in the middle and swept it back, and her sister often teased him about having movie star hair and said he looked like an actor when he was in one of his uniforms. He wasn't wearing a uniform today, however. He was wearing khaki cargo shorts. In Cassie's opinion, that eliminated instantly any chance at all that he might be mistaken for an actor. Sometimes her sister called him absent-minded, but Cassie rather doubted that he was ever inattentive at work. He was an engineer, and probably just compartmentalized. Everyone knew how bloody brilliant he was. She wished that she had told Buckley that last night, shown a little more pride in what he did. She'd said Dennis was sweet. She should have said he was smart. The guy, after all, helped dispose of chemical weapons. It was work, Cassie suspected, that was more dangerous than he was ever likely to admit to his family. No, it's a bookend, Cassie answered. I bought it at an antique store near the Spanish Steps in Rome.
They only had half?
She nodded.
I love it. A bookend about twins and half has gone missing, Dennis said. That may be the definition of irony. What will you use it for, son?
He asked Tim. The boy shrugged.
I don't know, but I like it. It's cool. I agree, said Dennis.
Then he bent over to look at the earrings that Cassie had brought his daughter, ooing and awing at their beauty. When he was done, he stood up straight and put back on his sunglasses.
You find the damnedest things in your travels, Cassie.
I guess.
No, I mean that. You bring back the most creative things. Me? Ask these two. The stuff I bring them back when I travel is way less interesting.
That's because you only go to places like Maryland and Washington, D.C. Rosemary tried to reassure him.
Nah, Cassie has a much better eye, he said. Really, they're perfect gifts.
Thank you, she said. She was touched. He was always so much kinder to her than Rosemary was, Cassie thought, even though he knew just as much as Rosemary did about her peccadilloes, great and small. But he was less judgmental. She had a feeling that when her name was attached to the dead body in Dubai, he would be far more surprised than his wife.
Chapter 17. Against the allegations that his people were brutish, Elena's father would smile and bring up the Bolshoi, Chekhov, Tchaikovsky. "We can be merciless," she once heard him remark as he studied the Ararat cognac in his snifter. "But we are no more and no less brutish than anyone else." It was over dinner with his old comrades from the KGB, most of whom now were more focused on their trophy dachas and trophy wives and the riches that they had found in the rubble of the once iconic wall. He reminded them how much Lenin loved novels and how literature was a part of the political world in which Lenin grew up. When Lenin wanted to belittle his rivals, he'd refer to them as particularly stupid or especially loathsome characters from Chernyshevsky, Pushkin, and Goncharov. "The biggest difference between an Oblomov and an oligarch?" he asked that night. "The setup for what he viewed as a bon mot?" "If an oligarch spends the day in bed, it's because he is a hooker and he's getting his money's worth." In his heart, of course, he knew that wasn't the biggest difference. Not at all. The oligarchs now had the wealth of Oblomov, but they weren't lazy, and they hadn't inherited their vast fortunes. Most of them were self-made. Corrupt, of course. Corrupt on a positively titanic scale. But they worked hard. And perhaps the only man before whom they would bow was the Russian president. They were alpha males who took no prisoners. Victor was, in her mind, a perfect example of that balancing act between barbarism and refinement. He was cold-blooded and feral beneath his crisp black suits, but he had constructed a veneer that compelled him to eat in small bites. He spoke in multiple languages fluently and appreciated the aesthetic of films by Tarkovsky. And he wasn't alone. Supposedly, even Stalin, as uncultured as they came and absolutely no fan of art for art's sake, died in 1953 with Russian pianist Maria Yudina's recording of Mozart's Concerto No. 23 playing on the nearby turntable. Elena opened the app on her phone and watched the little blue dot beat like a small, tiny heart, a frog's heart. It pulsed in and out, sending a fainter blue wave away from it in a perfect circle, before the wave would disappear and a new one would follow. The dot was her prey, and her prey was at the zoo. She put her phone down on the wooden bench and folded her arms across her chest. She looked up once at the Flatiron building, a block and a half to the south, and then at the young parents playing with their toddlers on the grass or walking their dogs along the paths that looped throughout Madison Square Park. The simple normalcy of the tableau was affecting. She felt a forlorn tug at her heart and shook her head ever so slightly, willing the melancholy away. This wasn't her world or her life, and it never would be. Not in Moscow and not in Manhattan. She was wearing nondescript khaki shorts, a sleeveless white blouse, and beige espadrilles. She had a magazine and a bag with a bagel in it, but only so it looked like she had a reason to be sitting on the bench. It was sunny but hot, the air damp and still, and she wished for a breeze. She really didn't know much about this neighborhood. The section of New York she knew best was Midtown west of Fifth, the great wide blocks of skyscrapers where Unisphere had its Manhattan office, and she'd probably only been there 4 or 5 times in her life. The family money, the family business, or part of the family business anyway. The part that came of age after the final collapse in 1991. She'd been but a toddler then. When she thought of this city, she thought first of lunches in the dark oak dining rooms with her father and the American managers of the fund while she was at college, before he was poisoned. The dining rooms packed with administrators and executives who seemed to eat and drink as if it were another era. The older adults occasionally still called each other comrade. They even called the Americans comrade, though there was now a trace of irony to the term. Of dinners alone with her father in nearby restaurants that were largely empty because they timed their meal to begin after the pre-theater crowd had left for their shows. Her father enjoyed coming to America, and he loved it when she was a freshman and a sophomore and would come south from Massachusetts to New York to meet him. He enjoyed these people. He probably would have enjoyed Sokolov, or at least gotten a kick out of him until he showed his true colors, because Alex's blood was so rich with Russian DNA. But her father was Russian through and through, and his trips to the United States were brief. He took pride in his accent. She, by design, had worked hard to lose any trace of hers. She'd certainly never been to the Empire State Building or the Metropolitan Museum or the Bronx Zoo. She rolled her eyes as if she weren't alone. The zoo, she thought. Really? The woman's life was unraveling and Cassandra Bowden had gone to the zoo? Based on the homework Elena had done on the flight attendant, she was most likely with her sister's family. She'd probably be with them all day, since they were in from Kentucky. Tomorrow night, she was supposed to fly out to Rome. The problem, she had told Victor now that she was here, was that Bowden lived in a building with doormen and porters, lots of them. This morning, a Saturday, Elena had watched as many as 3 different people behind the front desk at the entrance, or sweeping the sidewalk, or opening the door for residents and waving them politely out into the August heat. There were also cameras filming the reception area, and the elevator out from the basement and the parking garage that was attached by an underground cinderblock corridor. She knew from experience that it was much more difficult to remain invisible from the cameras in a private apartment building than it was in a hotel. There were so many fewer people coming and going in an apartment, and the lobby was dramatically smaller. So it would be difficult to get inside Bowden's apartment, which was unfortunate because home was where most suicides, 80%, occurred. A person's place of business accounted for nearly 10%, but even Victor had joked that no one wanted Elena to entertain that possibility. Sure, pilots occasionally brought down whole planes in a fit of selfish, suicidal madness, but no one wanted an Airbus on that side of the ledger. And if Elena couldn't easily get in and out of Bowden's apartment, then the flight attendant would have to take her life in some private nook in some relatively public space. The second issue, which Elena knew was painfully clear to everyone, was time. It was absolutely unimaginable what kind of damage a loose cannon like Cassandra Bowden could cause if Alex had told her something, or if suddenly she felt compelled to broadcast to anyone who would listen that another woman had come to room 511 that night in Dubai. And of course, the clock was running for her as well. Certainly there were people in Moscow who were shaking their heads at the way Dmitri's overly Americanized daughter had allowed the flight attendant to leave Dubai. They were at best confused and at worst alarmed. For all they knew, Bowden was CIA. Perhaps she was part of some military intelligence task force. And so they were angry. And these were the Cossacks. She knew what happened to anyone who pissed off this clandestine old guard. Her own father would have been appalled at what she had done, or to be precise, at what she had failed to do. She knew she was on thin ice. Victor had made that clear, not even masking the threat in a polite understatement. A thought came to her. The media still hadn't identified the woman in the sunglasses and scarf in the Royal Phoenician security camera photos. No one in the Dubai police had leaked the name of the flight attendant. Elena decided she would tell Victor that she needed that reveal before proceeding. Cassandra Bowden's suicide would be considerably more plausible if she'd been publicly shamed. She picked up her phone and watched the little blue dot. It would be great to take care of this, one way or another, before Bowden flew to Rome tomorrow evening. But now she could wait until the story broke. If Bowden's name wasn't online or in the newspapers by tomorrow morning, she'd go ahead and make the phone call to a newspaper or cable news network herself. She'd offer an anonymous tip. And in the meantime, she'd continue to watch Bowden and see if an opportunity of some sort presented itself. She wondered where the flight attendant and her family were having dinner tonight, and whether it might demand that the woman take a subway home.
Chapter 18. Cassie joined Rosemary and her family for dinner Saturday night at a crowded Cantonese restaurant that Rosemary had discovered online. It was a block south of Canal and closer than she would have liked to the FBI building on Broadway and Worth. She guessed she was only a 5-minute walk from yesterday afternoon's debacle. The restaurant catered to a tourist crowd that wanted to try dim sum. It was massive and loud and packed. But Cassie was surprised at how delicious the dumplings and pan-fried noodles were, and then felt guilty for having experienced a little culinary snobbishness before they had joined the throngs inside. Yes, she traveled a lot and had eaten all around the world, but just because tourists like something didn't mean it wasn't wonderful. Exhibit A, the peppermint macarons at the bakery near the Eiffel Tower. Besides, she was a flight attendant. It wasn't as if she was dining in La Pergola when she was in Rome. And she appreciated the sheer ordinariness of her sister and her family, the lack of drama, and the way the four of them knew each other's rhythms so well. There was just such comfort in the predictability. Cassie understood that she would never feel anything like this. Love born of certainty and ritual. Do you remember that awful Chinese restaurant in Grover's Mill? Rosemary was asking her now. She nodded. Her sister rarely brought up their childhood around Tim and Jessica. There were too many landmines, and you never knew when a memory would trip one. Of course I do. It's now a weirdly expensive clothing boutique, kind of like Anthropology. I mean, they had tops in there for $200. They must need a place to launder their crystal meth money, Cassie said, only half kidding. That's certainly one possible explanation. I agree. I don't know what's stranger, the fact the store exists, or the fact you know it's there. Were you actually back in Grover's Mill recently?
We all were, said Dennis. It was when we took the kids to that new amusement park that opened at the end of June. It's pretty close.
They have the steepest water slide in Kentucky, Jessica added.
The girl was using her spring roll a bit like a spoon to get as much peanut dipping sauce into her mouth as she could with each bite. And then you detoured to Grover's Mill? Cassie asked.
We did, her sister answered.
I thought it was time these two saw where their mother grew up.
I think we got the PG version, Tim said.
Cassie couldn't believe how many dumplings the boy had consumed, but he seemed sated now. He was sitting with his elbows on the table, his head in his hands, watching as the waiters wheeled the carts through the narrow spaces between the patrons.
Maybe, his mother agreed. But at least you saw the house. It was so tiny, said Jessica.
It was, Cassie thought. It really was. It was a small salt box, shabby with age, on less than half an acre. Their parents kept the booze in a kitchen cabinet, on the bottom shelf, which accommodated the taller bottles. The first time she started watering them down was when she was 9. Her father had come to the elementary school that day in June to watch the end-of-year field day contests. The three-legged races, the sack races, the sponge battles. She never did find out why he wasn't in the high school where he was supposed to be that afternoon, but he must have had an excuse. Wouldn't he have been fired if he'd just disappeared, or they'd known he was drunk when he left? It was right after lunch. He had interfered in the egg race, a relay race, meeting her on the center field grass where they were playing, and trying to coach her on how best to transfer the egg to her partner's spoon. It was shocking to see her father there, in the midst of the game, instead of with all the other teachers and administrators and a smattering of parents, the other grown-ups, off to the side. As he tried to assist her, breaking the rules in every imaginable way, he accidentally knocked the raw egg and her spoon to the ground, where it broke open, the bright yellow sun of the yolk exploding like a star, a supernova of shame. It had been mortifying, and Cassie hoped desperately that everyone supposed her father was merely clumsy and a cheater, not also a drunk. In her desperate embarrassment, she hoped they thought he was only an idiot. He had left soon after that, mumbling something about having to get back to the high school. That night was the first time that Cassie had crept from her bed while everyone else in the house was asleep and opened the cabinet where her parents stored the liquor. There was Jack Daniels, of course, but Cassie knew that was reserved for special occasions. Mostly her father drank a Scotch whiskey called Black Bottle, and the level of liquid was about at the top of the label. It was 3/4 full. She poured out an inch and then added an inch of tap water. She did the same with the vodka and the bourbon and the gin. She wished she could do the same with the beer in the refrigerator, but each can was sealed, and so that was impossible.
But I had my own bedroom there, Rosemary said, and Cassie felt herself wincing inside at the word there. Rosemary would go from there to the foster home, where she would share a strange bedroom with a strange girl, another teen in the foster care system, who was angry and violent, but could dial it down just enough in front of their foster parents to stick around. It was hard to believe that the salt box with a watered-down gin and their father's drinking and their mother's weeping and their weekly fights about money and booze was a well with sufficiently happy memories that Rosemary wanted to share the house with her children. How many evenings had Cassie tried to drown out their fights by cocooning inside her Walkman headset? How many nights had poor Rosemary crawled into bed with her, sobbing and scared?
More tea, Cassie?
Dennis was holding the pot near her teacup. Yes, please, she said, though she would have preferred a Long Island iced tea. Tequila, gin, vodka, rum, triple sec. The whole damn cabinet in a highball glass. At the table beside them, everyone had a bottle of Qingdao beer. She wanted one of those, too. And we actually had a very nice swing set and playhouse in the backyard, Rosemary went on. It was made of wood, not metal that rusted out as soon as it rained. My friends and I used to play Little House on the Prairie on it. The timbers were so thick and sturdy, they looked like they belonged on a log cabin.
That sounds like the lamest game ever, her son said.
Oh, it was, Rosemary agreed. Totally lame. But we were little. Cassie sipped her tea and recalled that moment after college when she broke her vow of alcohol abstinence. She was 23 and was at the swimming pool at a hotel in Miami. There were afternoon thunderstorms in the Northeast, and their flight back to New York had been canceled, and so the crew was sent to a hotel. It was in Coral Gables and had a rooftop pool. There were crews late that afternoon from three different carriers because the hotel filled its rooms in the summer, the off-season, with airline employees. Everyone was drinking, except her. The flight attendant on the chaise beside her, a motherly veteran who had been flying 25 years, was sipping a piña colada, and it smelled heavenly. Cassie considered ordering a virgin colada, but the waiter wasn't nearby. And the idea of getting up and going to the bar seemed like a lot of work at 5 in the afternoon, the temperature still in the mid-80s. And so she had taken a sip. And it was good. Better than a virgin colada, the taste sharper, the tingle deep, deep inside her. She inhaled the aromas of coconut and pineapple. Yes, but there was also something else. Something more. Rum. Had there ever been rum in her parents' kitchen in Kentucky? Probably. But she had no memory of watering down a bottle, or of her mother cascading rum down the sink. It felt different and new. And though she sensed she was flirting with something so wonderful, but, for her, so reckless that it would kill her, she pushed herself to her feet and walked to the pool bar in her bikini. She ordered a piña colada for herself. Did she even bother to nibble on the pineapple wedge? Probably not. She drank it fast because it was sweet, and she could feel the way it warmed her insides and made her worries go away. Suddenly, she wasn't fretting about her hips. They were fine. She was fine. She was no longer that girl who was scared in the back seat of the car as her drunken father tried to control their hideous robin's egg blue Dodge Colt on the winding road between Llandaff and Grover's Mill, her mother yelling at him to please, 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 for God's sake, let her drive. She wasn't that anxious college student, awake at 4 a.m. at the college switchboard, praying to herself that her kid sister would be okay in the foster home. She wasn't that diligent, joyless, unremittingly responsible 23-year-old flight attendant who strove for perfection in all things, because anything else was the start of the downward slope that would lead her back to the small, sad village where her father drank and her mother cried, and she was pouring black bottle down the sink. She was free. And she liked that. She enjoyed the taste, sure, but more than that, she liked the sound of her laugh when the first officer made a joke. Not especially funny, but he was cute. About the way a particular cloud in the sky over Miami looked like a puppy with a cigar. That evening, he would seduce her, or she would seduce him. In hindsight, even the next morning, she really hadn't a clue. She learned quickly that music sounded better, people were nicer, and she was prettier when life's rough edges had been smoothed over with a little alcohol. Or, better still, with a lot. What fault could anybody possibly find in any of that? God, it was good. It was all good. And it was all Cassie could do that very moment in the Chinese restaurant not to violate Rosemary's rules and summon the waiter to bring her a Tsingtao too. Or better yet, a gin and tonic made with Beefeater, or Sacred, or Sipsmith, if they had it.
I'm reading a book about a pilot,
her niece was saying to her, and Cassie turned to her and tried to focus.
Oh, tell me about it, she said.
And her niece did, and she tried to pay attention. But a part of her was recalling the denial that marked her drinking in her early and mid-20s, and how she convinced herself that she wasn't her father's daughter and she wasn't repeating his mistakes. She wouldn't let alcohol destroy her the way it had destroyed him. And for over a decade and a half, until Dubai, on some level she had even believed that. Because it wasn't until Dubai that she had really become one with her father, by allowing her addiction to lead her to the dead. You can repair anything but dead. You can't fix that. So you buried the dead and moved on. You burned the carbons. The proof was in the proof. And yet she wanted that gin and tonic. Even now. Even as she waited for a phone call from Ani Maradian or Frank Hammond. She wanted it badly.
Can I borrow the book when you're done? She asked Jessica. Sure, but it's a kid's book.
She shrugged. A lot of the best books are kids' books. Charlotte's Web, The Giver, Matilda. It's a long list. She smiled at the girl and then told the table that she was going to the ladies' room. She planned to drop a 10 with a bartender on the way there, curl her tongue into a funnel, and drain a shot glass of gin. Dennis didn't mind driving in New York City. He rather liked it, in fact. His big complaint was the cost of parking. But the hotel where they were staying in White Plains was reasonable, and so he had driven to the Bronx Zoo, which had made it easy for them all to drive to Chinatown. Then, after dinner, he insisted on chauffeuring Cassie back to her apartment. She invited them all upstairs, but it had been a long day, and Dennis really didn't want to park again. So she said her goodbyes in the car and exited at the corner of 3rd Avenue and 27th Street, waving at Noah the doorman the moment she emerged from the car. She was in her apartment by 8 o'clock. If she hadn't had a shot of gin at the bar at the restaurant in Chinatown, would she have stayed home once she had settled down inside her apartment? Probably not, because Paula phoned, her siren song drawing Cassie once more toward the rocks, the magical cubes that added such beauty to the luminescent brown of Drambuie and transformed the waters of Arak into clouds. Briefly, she considered not answering when she saw Paula's name on her phone's screen, but willpower had never been her strong suit. And so she did answer, which meant that by 9 she was drinking at the bar at a Mexican restaurant near Union Square with her friend and a woman from Paula's ad agency named Suzanne. And by 10 she was telling the two of them a version of her nightmare in Dubai, in which Alex Sokolov himself didn't appear, but instead she slept with a fictional commodities trader named Alex Ilyich, a surname she commandeered on the fly from Tolstoy. But she was certainly imagining the real Alex as she spoke, giving her fictional one that same peculiar Jones for the Russians and Russian literature. Alex, she said, had told her that he would be back in the States and visiting his parents in Virginia this week. The man, she added, had promised to call her when he was stateside, but never had. Never even texted. Which perhaps was why now she was allowing them to prod her to call him at his parents' place in Charlottesville.
"Do it!"
Paula said raucously over the sound of the crowd and clinked glasses and the thrum of the bass from the speakers on the far side of the bar.
"Do it! Call him! Give him shit for fucking and forgetting!"
Cassie gazed at her friend and at her friend's friend. Their eyes hung heavy with tequila, and their smiles had that Saturday night smirk, thin-lipped and derisive, but also eager for a rush to cap the weekend with a pulsating vibrato of hilarity and chaos.
"I don't have his number," she said. "So? Call Charlottesville! Call his parents! How many people there have unpronounceable Russian last names?"
And so to appease them, she pretended to search for Ilyich in that Virginia city, but actually looked up Sokolov. She found that name instantly. She pressed in the digits, let it ring once, and then hung up. She felt at once mournful and brutish. She knew she would be unable to endure the sound of Alex's mother's or father's voice on an answering machine, or the voice of whoever was screening calls at the house the night after the funeral.
"Busy," she said.
"Like hell it was,"
said Suzanne, rapping her knuckles on the wood of the bar, then laughing and moaning at how she had banged them so hard that she'd hurt herself.
"You're a coward and a wimp."
"No, it was busy," she insisted. "It really was." "No way,"
Paula laughed, rolling back her head. With the speed of an attacking snake, she grabbed Cassie's phone and pressed on the number that Cassie had just dialed. Cassie tried to wrestle the phone away, but Suzanne held down her right arm, and then her left, and then bear-hugged her and giggled. Cassie didn't struggle, not because she feared making a scene. She never feared making a scene. But because a part of her had to see where this speeding train was going to crash, and just how cataclysmic would be the carnage.
"Hi, this is Cassie Bowden," Paula said when someone answered. "I met Alex last week in Dubai, and I want to speak to him right now. I want to know why he hasn't called me."
She watched as Paula's drunken eyes went wide, and her jaw actually went slack in disbelief. She said nothing more, nothing at all. She just handed the phone back to Cassie as Suzanne released her arms. Cassie looked at the screen and saw the connection was gone.
He's,
her friend began, but then stopped. Cassie waited. Suzanne pushed Paula hard on her upper arm, literally prodding her to continue.
"What?"
Suzanne asked, still smiling at the hilarity of all of this.
"What?"
"He's dead," Paula murmured.
"He's what?"
Suzanne asked.
"He's dead,"
Paula repeated.
"Someone at the house, not his mom or dad, I'm pretty sure, got really pissed and hung up. So, I don't know any more than that."
"That's so weird and so sad," Suzanne said, her voice softened by the absolute buzzkill of Paula's news. But she was stunned only briefly.
"Let's Google how he died," she said. "Maybe there's an obituary."
Cassie took back her phone. It felt radioactive in her hand. Would it ring again soon? Would Alex's mother or father call her back? Probably not. Instead, she would probably get a call from Frank Hammond or someone in authority somewhere telling her not to harass the family. But maybe not. Oh, the family certainly would tell the police she had called. They'd tell the FBI. And eventually, it would get back to Ani. But the more she thought about it, the more she wondered whether this stupid little stunt would be anything other than one more black mark in her file somewhere. She sighed. She hoped when Ani called her next, it wouldn't be to say that she'd had enough of her and was dropping the case.
"Don't waste your time Googling it, Suzanne," she said. "I can tell you exactly how he died."
Paula sat up a little straighter on her stool.
"Wait, what? You knew he was dead and allowed me to call his parents? Are you crazy?"
"I tried to stop you."
"She did,"
Suzanne agreed.
"She did.
Not hard enough.
He was killed in Dubai at some point after I left his hotel room, Cassie told them. If you want to read all about it, just go to the New York Post. You can even see me. Sort of. His real name was Alex Sokolov, not Ilyich. Sokolov. She had been planning to order another margarita and stared a little longingly at the squat, lovely bottle of triple sec behind the bar. But as she glimpsed the faces of her friends as they held their phones before them and read about the death of an American trader in Dubai and the woman of interest in the security cam photos, she had a change of heart. She had a $20 bill and two ones in her wallet, which wouldn't cover what she probably owed, but she handed it to Paula and said she was sorry. Sorry, in truth, about so many things, of which not paying her share of the bar tab was pretty damn inconsequential, and said goodnight. The next morning, Sunday, she wasn't sure which surprised her more, the fact she slept through the night or the fact she still hadn't been arrested. Her attorney hadn't called to fire her for phoning Alex Sokolov's family in Virginia. Of course, the day was young. A lot could still happen. She got up and went to the animal shelter, as if it were just another Sunday in August. It was a 15-minute walk if she strolled, considerably less if she was in a hurry. But as she was passing a supermarket on the avenue, once more she had the distinct sense that she was being followed. She told herself, as she had the other day, that she was being delusional. But she knew also that the FBI had reason to put her under surveillance. And there certainly were other people out there, including whoever had killed Alex, who might want to know more about the woman in the Royal Phoenician photos. The idea that whoever that was who knew who she was caused her to feel a chill, despite the stifling summer heat. She paused and flipped open her compact to look behind her, almost hoping to see Frank Hammond or someone else who just exuded FBI, because she knew she would have preferred that to the faceless man in shades and a black ball cap. Unless that dude was FBI. And maybe he was. She thought of how casually the air marshals always dressed on her flights. In her compact, she saw no one in particular on the sidewalk. There wasn't a lot of traffic on the streets on a Sunday morning in August, and among the cabs and buses and delivery vehicles, she noted nothing suspicious. Still, she trusted her instincts. There again was that gift of the amygdala, the gift of fear. Ahead of her was a corner convenience store with entrances on both the avenue she was on and the cross street she was approaching. She flipped shut her compact and went in. But instead of buying even a cup of coffee, she cut through the store and left through the other exit. A few yards down that cross street was a doorway for a dry cleaner that was closed for the day. She stood flat against the side wall, invisible from the avenue, and waited. She counted slowly to 100, adding the word Mississippi after each number, the way she'd been taught as a girl. Then instead of returning to the avenue and continuing north to the shelter, she walked a block west. She'd head north at the next intersection. It was a long detour, but it dialed down her panic. And she indeed felt safer when she was inside the shelter, though she knew that wasn't rational. If they wanted to arrest her, they would. An animal shelter wasn't an embassy in some faraway land giving her refuge. Likewise, if someone else was after her, they'd find her. Their expertise was evident. She went straight to the community room where the older cats lived. This morning she counted 8, dozing or draped on the cat condos and the cat trees and on the cat beds on the bookcase. She saw Duchess and Dulcie were still there, a pair of 11-year-olds whose elderly owner had died and his middle-aged son had been unwilling to adopt. She had never met the man who had brought the animals in, but Cassie loathed him and viewed his behavior as utterly despicable. The cats recognized her voice and went straight for her lap when she sat on the floor. She brushed them and cooed, and they purred in response, the noise reminiscent of mourning doves,
and they nuzzled against her and stretched out their legs and their paws. They looked a little thinner than the last time she was here, and she hoped they weren't so sad that they weren't eating. She reached into her shoulder bag and offered them some of the treats she had brought, and was relieved when their appetites seemed fine. She sighed. Was there any place she was more useful than the shelter? Was there any place she was happier when she was sober? She knew the answer to both of those questions. There wasn't. As she was walking back to her apartment, once again she had the unmistakable feeling that she was being watched. She guessed she probably was. She recalled the way the half-brother of the North Korean leader had been killed in broad daylight with a fast-acting nerve agent by a stranger in an airport concourse in Malaysia, and found herself giving a wide berth on the sidewalk to anyone approaching her from the other direction. And yet soon she was home, and the walk had been, by any objective standard, uneventful. And still she hadn't been arrested. She sat down on the couch and called Ani.
"Oh, I wish I could tell you that you're off the hook and this all will pass," Ani said. "Maybe it's just taking time."
"In that case, do I report to work and fly back to Rome? If so, I should be out the door in an hour."
"Go."
"Okay. And maybe I should just stay there. Never come back," she said wryly.
"Maybe," Ani agreed.
But Cassie understood the lawyer wasn't being serious. "I did something stupid last night," she confessed. And she told Ani what had occurred at the bar. But instead of firing or even chastising her, Ani sounded as if she had come to expect this sort of bad behavior from her client. There was an edge of disappointment to her response, but mostly she just sounded sad.
"Someday you'll hit bottom," she said. "For most people, that would have been Dubai. Not you, apparently. We'll see."
"How much trouble am I in?" she asked.
"For calling the Sokolov family in Virginia? Oh, probably no more than yesterday. You should be embarrassed, but I'm not sure it's really possible to shame you, Cassie."
"It is," she said. "It really is."
"Just..."
"Just what?"
"Just... please, act like a grown-up."
While packing, Cassie called Derek Mays. "Have you heard anything from the airline about... I don't know. They're asking me to take a leave of absence?" she asked. "Are there any threats to my job?"
"Not yet," he told her.
"Does the airline know I'm the woman in the photos?"
"They might. If I had to guess, I would guess yes. I'm quite sure that someone from the FBI has contacted them. But no one from the airline has gotten in touch with you?"
"Nope."
"Well, they haven't called me either."
"Your niece says I should go ahead and fly to Rome."
"My niece is very smart. Listen to her in all things."
"I will," she said, though she instantly recalled how she hadn't with the FBI agents that Friday afternoon. A half hour later, unsure whether it was the August humidity or that nagging sense that there was always someone just beyond her gaze who was watching her, she said goodbye to Stanley, the doorman. Briefly, she considered taking the subway to the Dickinson and hitching a ride with the crew for the Madrid flight, but she couldn't cope. She just couldn't. Instead, she hailed the cab nearing her apartment building's awning. Her instinct was to ask him to take her to Grand Central, where she would catch the airport or bus. But she couldn't face that either. Not now. Not today. And so even though she couldn't afford a cab to JFK, with tip that would cost $75, she asked him to take her to the airport. And there in the cab, somewhere in the snarl of traffic that dogged the Van Wyck Expressway even on a Sunday afternoon in August, her phone rang. It was a number she didn't recognize. When the woman said hello and introduced herself as a reporter, Cassie instantly forgot her name and had to ask for it a moment later because her mind could focus only on the tabloid banner of the writer's newspaper. When she recovered, she said she had nothing to say and hung up.
blocked the number on her phone, and called Ani Maradian.
Chapter 19. In the end, Elena chose the New York Post for the simple reason that the New York Times had covered the story responsibly. They understood the death of Alex Sokolov was not an act of terrorism and seemed, as far as she could tell now, to have moved on. They might be preparing a longer story on the hedge fund manager and Unisphere's connections to select members of the Russian political leadership. There might be the usual innuendo about corruption and crime, intimations that the White House was indebted to the Kremlin, but the financial machinations of a hedge fund were at once too complex and too dull to ever elicit much readership or interest. And if they were preparing a story on the utter randomness of dying on a business trip far from home? Elena believed that reportage like that might be compelling and beautiful, but it would never gain traction in the age of the troll, in the age of mass shootings, in the age of the suicide bomb in the crowd. After planting her seed, her anonymous tip, she phoned Victor. He was finishing dinner but took the call and went outside the restaurant. She wondered whom he was with and worried when he didn't volunteer the companion's name. Usually he did because most of the time it was someone she knew or at least knew of. It was a further indication of the sort of trouble she herself was in. He didn't trust her, at least not completely. "Are you going to go with the flight attendant?" he asked. "Back to Italy?" She heard incredulity instead of obedience in her voice, a reflex, and took a breath to rein in her emotions. "If that's where she's going, yes." "No, I hadn't planned on it," she admitted. She wasn't a pilot or a flight attendant, and her body wasn't wild about the idea of flying east to Rome days after flying west from Dubai. "You might want to consider it." "Might want to." Was there ever a more passive-aggressive phrasing? There was a threat behind it, only thinly veiled, but there was also a message. She was responsible for Bowden. This was a mess of her making. Their patience was almost up. "Do you want me to finish the job in Rome?" she asked guardedly. She heard him lighting a cigarette, pulling the smoke deep into his lungs. "Well, I like your idea of a suicide. In some ways, I like it even more in Rome than in New York. Just be sure that she has had time to really feel the pain from the media swarm. You know, cause and effect. But a hotel suicide in Rome the day the story appears in the New York Post? Makes perfect sense." "Then I'll go. Just don't be on her flight." "Victor?" "Yes." She almost told him that she wasn't born yesterday. She felt the need to defend herself and convey at least a hint of her annoyance at the imposition of another trip across the Atlantic. But she knew that sort of flippancy would be ill-advised at the moment. And so instead she said simply, "You are absolutely right. I'll make sure I'm not." It was the politic response, and she loathed herself for saying it. She flew out of Newark, since Bowden was based at JFK. She didn't want to risk the flight attendant spotting her at the terminal on Long Island. She was stopped at security, a random pat-down and wanding. The TSA officer opened her leather duffel and commented on both the wig and the straw sun hat with pretend strands of hair attached to the side and rear panels. She volunteered that they were for her sister in Orvieto, who was about to begin chemotherapy. On the other side of the full-body scanners, people were standing like storks on single legs as they pulled their boots over their shins or slipped back on their sneakers and espadrilles. A moment later, when she was repacking the wig and the sun hat properly, the way she liked, not the way the TSA agent had mashed them inside her bag, she wondered if she wore them in Rome tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, whether someone would recall them from a woman's bag back in Newark. Not likely. They were all too busy looking for shoe bombs. There were actually a few empty seats in coach on the Sunday night flight, including the middle seat beside her. She had grown interested in flight attendants in a way that she hadn't been before Bowden had shown up in Alex's hotel room. And now, almost curiously, she watched a slim woman with white hair and athletic calves work the aisles, asking passengers what they would like to drink as she stood behind the cart, but occasionally responding,